So in this talk, E star is going to be a torus equivariant complex oriented cohomology theory maybe not. Okay, just thought that the battery fell. Yeah, it's on. Is it now working? Not really? Okay. I'll try to speak while looking at you and loud. Okay, so I don't want it to be any complex-oriented cohomology theory. I want it to have some good properties. So whenever alpha is in lambda, which I'm going to define to be home from my torus into S1, that's the characters of T, whenever alpha is a character which is not zero, alpha not zero, I want this to imply that the Euler class of alpha, that's an element of E2 of a point. I'm going to explain how it's defined momentarily. E of alpha, I want it to be not a zero divisor. Moreover, if I have a collection alpha 1 up to alpha k of characters of my torus such that no two of them are collinear. No two of them collinear, then I want the corresponding Euler classes E of alpha 1, E of alpha k to be relatively prime. As elements of E star T of a point. So these are fairly mild assumptions, and some examples of cohomology theories that satisfy these assumptions are Borel equivariant cohomology with integer coefficients, or equivariant K-theory, or equivariant complex cobordism. So let me maybe say a few words about what complex-oriented means. So complex-oriented means that if you look at the Thom space of the universal line bundle over equivariant CP infinity. So what is equivariant CP infinity? It's the projective space of the direct term over all alphas of C alpha is going to be the representation. I mean, alpha is a character, so pick some C alpha. So I take infinitely many copies of each representation, add them all together, take the projective space of that. There is a tautological line bundle. Thom space of that comes with a class X in E2 torus equivariant of this whole Thom space, such that X is an orientation for L. So this means that for any orbit in this space, for any T orbit in this space, in P of direct sum C alpha infinity, I want the restriction of X, so I can restrict X to the Tom space of L restricted to that orbit. So then I take let me just write X, the image of X, of that X in this restricted bundle. So this is equivalent to torus equivariant. That's equivalent to the E2 of, and just take the stabilizer as my equivariance group instead of the full torus, where the stabilizer is a stabilizer of the orbit. And there's going to be some, let me just write like that. There's going to be a degree shift of a point. So this is just essentially the suspension isomorphism equivalently. I want this to be a generator of this as a module over this. That's the condition. So X is a generator of this as a module over this. So this is actually a free module, a free rank one module over that. And I'm not going to insist that X restricts to one, just going to insist that it restricts to a generator. Okay, so now let me define these Euler classes. If I have, so I can look at the inclusion of the fiber over some point. So take one of these C alphas and view it as a point in the projective space. So I have in there, I have a map from S alpha, the fiber over that C alpha, one point compactified. And then inside that S alpha, I have the base point, which is the point at infinity, and I have another point, which is zero, which is includes into the sphere. So take X, which lives in E2 of that guy, and its image here is what is called the Euler class of alpha, or C1 of alpha, that's the same thing. So maybe a couple of remarks on how these are defined in these respective interesting cohomology theories. So in, maybe I should do it over there. In usual cohomology, one defines E alpha to be the usual Euler class of the Borel construction on alpha, cross ET over T mapping to BT. That's an element of H2 of BT, which is the same thing by definition as H2T of a point. In K-theory, E of alpha is just 1 minus alpha. So alpha is a bundle over the point, represents an element in torus equivariant K-theory of a point. So does 1. Take that difference. I'm aware of the fact that there are sign issues. People take different sign conventions. This is going to be my sign convention. And
And then
in mu, then I can look at the component p c alpha infinity in p of this direct sum over all alphas of c alpha infinity. So that's a component of this space. This space naturally maps into the standard construction of the Tom spectrum mu. I guess I didn't define it, but you just take it. It's built out of all these Tom spectra, and they map into each other, and that's sort of the thing that comes in degree two. It's this classifies equivariant line bundles. So if I have an element of pi naught of my second space, I mean a component of the fixed point set, so that's an element of pi naught of the second space, it becomes an element of pi minus two of my spectrum, which is the same thing as mu upper two of a point. Okay, so I want to compute E star T for generalized flag varieties, G mod P. So maybe I should say a couple of words about flag varieties. Maybe I'm going to turn this projector on, let you stare at its slide, and then I'm going to come back to it. First going to say some facts. Is it possible to read this slide? Kind of. Oh well, I'll maybe comment it and read it loud. Okay, so some key facts about G mod P. So G is a complex algebraic group, and actually we can also let G run among the class of all Kac-Moody groups, and P is a parabolic. Oh, I forgot to mention, that this is joint work with Tara Holm and Megumi Harada. And the version of the result that I'm talking about today appeared on the archive. When did it appear, Megumi? Like, yeah, a week ago, 10 days ago. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the equivariant skeleton of G mod P. First thing, the zero skeleton is going to be very important. The zero skeleton coincides with the fixed point set and is equal fixed point set. I guess I should have said which torus acts. The torus that acts is the maximal torus of G modulo the center of G. So it's the torus of the adjoint form of G. I mean, it's easy to see that the center acts trivially on this thing. So it's the fixed point set under the action of the torus, which is a coset of the Weyl group of G by the Weyl group of P. than the one skeleton. So I'm talking about the equivariant one skeleton. So equivariantly, a one cell is something of the form an interval cross an orbit. So they're actually going to be two-dimensional things, but it's legitimate to call it the one skeleton. And they, so the one cells, the equivariant one cells, if I have two fixed points, which I'm going to call W, I mean, W is an element of WG, and I put it into brackets to denote the coset. So there exists a one cell between W and the reflection of W along some root alpha. So these are the reflections in the Weyl group. And my equivariant one cell is going to be something that looks like C star. And the torus acts on it by rotating via some character, and the action of T on this one cell is alpha, the root that I used to go from here to here. Note that if I know R alpha, alpha is only defined up to sine, but so is the action, so is the notion of character for an action on C star. I mean, if I decide this to be zero, then it becomes alpha. If I decide this to be zero, it becomes minus alpha. And this is going to be irrelevant. So my elements of my characters are going to be defined up to sine. Let's see. So how am I going to draw these G mod P? I'm going to draw them by drawing a graph that represents the equivariant one skeleton. So that graph is going to have a vertex for each element of WG mod WP. So here you can see some examples. Maybe I'm going to reproduce one of them in big here so that you can see it somewhere. Bigger. So in this particular example, I'm taking the value group of G to be S3 and the value group of P to be trivial. So P is actually the parabolic, and my group is SU3. And I put one edge for each equivariant one cell. So note that there is an edge if and only if a vertex is obtained from another one by applying a simple reflection. And this is the equivariant one skeleton in this case of the flag manifold of complete flags on C3. So this is what Taramegumin and I call the GKM graph in honor of Goreski, Kotwitz, and McPherson, who first proved a theorem which is analogous to what we're proving, except that they were working in ordinary cohomology with complex coefficients. So this GKM graph, and here you have a couple more examples, one for CP2, and the GKM graph is a triangle, here for the variety of isotropic lines in C5 with respect to some symmetric form, the flag variety of spin, the G2 example. And here I also have an infinite dimensional example, a homogeneous space for the loop group of SU2. And that homogeneous space turns out to be based loops on SU2. It's also called the affine Grassmannian. Okay, so this GKM graph is not just an abstract graph, it's a graph that comes with labeling. Each edge is labeled by a weight, alpha. And this way of drawing the picture was actually not chosen randomly. The way I drew it is I look at the action of the viral group of G on the dual of the Lie algebra of T. So the viral group of G acts on the dual of the Lie algebra of T. I pick a point in the dual of the Lie algebra whose stabilizer is exactly WP. Equal to WP, and then I take its viral group orbit, and this is what I draw for the vertices. So, vertices of my graph gamma is the WG orbit of that point. And then I draw an edge between any two points that are obtained from each other by a simple reflection. And this has the advantage that the weight alpha of each edge is now encoded by the direction of the edge. So this GKM graph lives inside T star by this definition, and so does the lattice lambda of characters of the torus. So if I have an edge, there exists a unique character, which is the smallest character in the direction of the edge. Again, it's defined up to sine. This smallest character is exactly the character labeling the edge and encoding the action, encoding which type of cell I have. So this action is alpha equal direction of edge. And these examples of GKM graphs have been drawn using that recipe. So you have all the information you need. And in the last one, I also included the lattice lambda. Okay. So now I guess I can state our main result. First, the restriction map from the T-equivalent cohomology, K-theory, MU-theory of G mod P to that of the fixed points and that's, of course, just a product indexed over that quotient of viral groups, WG mod WP, of E star of a point, torus equivariant, is injective. A second theorem which is the one that actually generalizes the result of Goreski, Kotwitz, and McPherson. I should write in their names. Goreski, Kotwitz, McPherson generalizes result of these guys. Is a theorem that characterizes the image. Let's call this a user upper star. So a class X of V. So V is an element in WG mod WP, and each X of V lives in one of these factors, and this collection lives in this product, which is this thing. Lies in the image of iota upper star if and only if I'll keep it here. E of alpha divides X of V minus X of R alpha V for all V in there and all alpha a root. So it's a simple combinatorial formula that is actually very handy to work with. Theorem 3. It's a collection X sub V. So each X sub V now belongs in E star T of G mod P. Satisfies X sub V. This will be my notation for the class X sub V restricted at the point W. I'm just using this so that it's coherent with this notation. Equals 0 when W is smaller than V in the Bruha order. And X sub V at the point V is equal to the product of the Euler classes of alpha, where alpha is such that, okay, let me write it here. Alpha is such that R sub alpha of V smaller than V. So I said that all the guys below V have to be zero, and the guy at V is going to be the first guy that's non-zero. Then I have all these conditions that the difference needs to be divisible by these Euler classes. So this product of Euler classes is really the smallest thing it could possibly be at that point. So if it's that thing exactly, then this collection XV forms a basis of E star T of G mod P as an E star T module. Then XV form a basis of ET star G mod T as an ET star of a point module. So implicitly I'm saying that this is free. Okay. So now what? Maybe I should give you an example of show why these things hold in a small baby example, which is the case when I have a unique equivariant one cell. So my space is actually a two sphere. And and pretty much all the arguments are in there. So X equals some two sphere. Let's see, how do I want to is some two sphere with the following action. So I have an action where the weight is going to be alpha. So I have a point, say this point. Let's give them names. Let's call this one South Pole and this one North Pole. So I have the South Pole maps into X, maps down to S alpha. So here one needs to be careful. X I view it as an unbased point. S alpha I view it as the based. X is an unbased space. S alpha is the base space, where the base point is the South Pole. This is a cofiber sequence, which is split. And so if I apply E star T to that, I'm going to get E star T of S alpha maps to E star T of X maps to E star T of my South Pole. And so the map I care about is the map restriction to fixed points. So let's draw the fixed points right under. So here I have E star T of the point set South Pole, North Pole. Here I have again E star T of the South Pole. And here I have a unique fixed point, which is not the base point. So I really have E star T of North Pole mapping there. And this is split because this was split. So this is an isomorphism. This is the map I care about. This is the map that I'm going to show is injective right now. So how do I show this is injective? That's the same thing by the suspension isomorphism with just E star T of a point. And this composite here, so suspension and then restrict to the zero of my S alpha, is how I defined times E alpha. E alpha was assumed not to be a zero divisor. That was the very first thing I said. Therefore, this map is injective, and this map, therefore, is also injective. In general, if I build my G mod P out of adding cells, each time I'm going to have something here which I know is already injective, something I care about, something which looks like just the sphere of some representation, that representation split into characters. That map is just multiplication by the product of the corresponding Euler classes, therefore injective, and so that's how the argument runs. There's really nothing, nothing hard about it. So maybe now we can identify explicitly the images. Let's use this one since I cleaned it. May as well use it. So here, there was this splitting, which induces a splitting here. And I'm going to view this as a subspace here, as the summand given by the splitting, and same thing for this one. And I care about the image. The image is everything, because that's an isomorphism, and this is a diagonal inclusion, because that was the map that sort of projects both points to the same thing. So here I have the set of x, comma x. Here, I'm just including this into there by forgetting that South Pole was the zero, was the base point. Therefore, I'm going to map this into zero, comma, E of alpha times something. That's the image of the map here. Then I direct from those two guys, and it's really a trivial exercise to see that's the same thing as the set of xy, such that E of alpha divides x minus y. So that's how these conditions show up. So now maybe I can give one of the inclusions of theorem two. So the inclusion that says that if I have a class in the image of iota star, then it satisfies those guys. That's I guess the easy inclusion. And the argument goes as follows. Suppose I have a class in the image of iota star, then I can restrict it to any one of these spheres, those spheres that compose the equivariant one skeleton, and then restrict further to the fixed points. So if I have two points that are linked by one of these things, one of these edges, then I know that the image of my restriction map factors through this map here, and for this one I've computed explicitly the image. So it needs to satisfy this relation for any edge. Are there any questions? Okay, so maybe I'm going to go ahead and show you some examples of computations using these theorems. Let's see. So this. So now my space is a homogeneous space for the group G2. And the parabolic that I'm choosing is obtained by the Borel subgroup and the exponential of the simple long negative root. I am representing these cohomology classes via their restriction to the fixed points. So I'm actually not drawing anything on this side. I'm also only drawing things on that side. And whenever I have an arrow that's drawn in one of these, on one of these vertices, one should interpret that this means the corresponding Euler class in whatever cohomology theory we're working with. So I should say that this computation is a computation that's written in a way that sort of works both for cohomology case. I mean, it works for all complex-oriented cohomology theories at the same time. So these are the module generators of E star T G mod P as an E star T point module. So what needs to be shown that to see that these are the module generators? Well, I need to know that a class X restricts to zero below the thing that it's supposed to start at. So this guy starts here, this guy starts here, and these restrict to zero here, this guy starts here, and hey, I'm going to use this one. This guy here starts here and is zero there. This guy starts there and is zero before. This guy starts there and zero before. And this guy starts there and is zero everywhere else. So this condition, this, is satisfied. And now I'm going to look at this condition. So this guy here is indeed the product of all the Euler classes pointing to the zero, and this is indeed... What? Oh, well, fine. That's the product and so on. So now these things can be used to do actual explicit computations. For example, here's a computation in homology. Maybe you're not able to see very well since it's below the level of this projector. So like that is maybe going to be easier. So you just write so here I'm writing A and B for the Euler classes of the things pointing in the corresponding directions. If I multiply X by X plus A, so X was this guy here on the top and was zero here, and X plus A is made exactly so that it vanishes at this point. I multiply them, I get something that vanishes at both points, it's actually Y. If I do the same trick to make it vanish at 3 points, I see that I get twice this class Z. So great, I get twice Z, and then I do it again and I get twice X and twice T. And so this allows to compute, for example, if you're not interested in equivariant cohomology, but you just want ordinary cohomology, you can tensor over the equivariant cohomology of a point with just Z in this case, which means set these A and B to zero, and you get the answer. So it's generated, has six classes, and if you have like X, X squared, X cubed, and then X cubed suddenly has one half of it that also lies in the ring, and then it continues up to X5 over 2. So the condition that's sort of not completely trivial is that these classes that I put up here are indeed in the image of Iota star. So how does one check that these conditions are very satisfied? I mean, I'm just writing something that lives in there. I mean, I need to know that it lands in Iota upper star. And this is a relatively easy lemma. Where do I want to put it? Way up there. So, if I want to know that E alpha divides E beta minus E gamma, because I have, for example, here I want to know that this E alpha, where alpha is horizontal, divides the difference of this guy and this guy. And I'm saying that is the case. When beta minus gamma is parallel to alpha. So actually, let me just show you when beta minus gamma equals alpha, and the other one is easy there. So in cohomology, E of alpha essentially is alpha, viewed as an element of H2. E of beta minus E of gamma is beta minus gamma. So if that's equal to that, then indeed alpha divides alpha. In K-theory, it's again very easy to check it directly from the definition of Euler classes in K-theory. In general, we just use the fact that if I have E of alpha plus beta, so these are now different from these alphas and betas. Let's just put primes, whatever. So that's usually E of alpha prime plus E of beta prime plus higher terms out of the form E of alpha prime, E of beta prime times stuff. So that's essentially the unit condition on the formal group law corresponding to E cohomology. And then if I want to obtain this from that, I just let this be beta, and this beta here be gamma, and this stays alpha, so alpha doesn't have a prime actually. And then if I take E of beta minus E of gamma, what I end up is something that indeed is divisible by E of alpha. E of alpha here, E of alpha here. So that's just it. So this implies that whenever I have a collection E of beta I, of which I'm taking the product, as I did in this picture. So whenever I have one of these bouquet of arrows, this represents the product, and I do this difference of product, that E of alpha divides that when beta I minus gamma I is parallel to alpha for each pair I. So that's just some algebra. You write this difference, you put a bunch of sort of like, instead of having this difference, you first do the product of the beta I's, and then at the last one you put beta k minus gamma k, and then you have the product of the beta I's up to like the before the last one, and then you have the difference, and then it's just a very easy consequence of this thing there. So to check that these guys indeed are satisfy these relations, we see that whenever I have an edge, look at, for example, this edge here, I can sort of order my arrows so that they line up. So here's this is the picture. I have a point here, a bouquet of arrows, and I want somehow to have them lined up nicely, where I sort of allow to translate them by some multiple of alpha, where alpha is this guy here. And that's the beta I, and these are the gamma I's. So just look at these guys and see that whenever I have an edge, this condition is satisfied. This does the trick. So let me go maybe to another example. Here are the first few generators of cohomology on loops SU2. So that's a G mod P, where G is the free loops on SU2. And so you just write these things down and see that they satisfy these relations. And then one can actually write y, z, and the ones that come after algebraically in terms of x. So let me do it. So for example, y would be written as x times x minus this arrow divided by 2, and by this arrow I really mean the Euler class of the corresponding character. So indeed, x was 0 at that point, and x minus that arrow is going to be 0 at this other point. I multiply them, I get something which is a multiple of y, turns out to be twice y. And z is x times x minus this arrow times x minus this arrow, and now over 6, and so on. So by going to non-equivalent cohomology, we just omit these arrows, and we'll recover the well-known fact that cohomology on loops S3 is a divided powers algebra on a class X. These arrows here, unfortunately, don't work for all cohomology theories at the same time. They just work for ordinary cohomology. So let me tell you what happens with K-theory, because that's also something that can be computed. So the answer is slightly more complicated, but it's still very explicit. So now one needs to introduce some function of Euler classes, which is slightly more complicated than just their product. So I'm going to take the product of the Euler classes. These 1 minus xi are going to be exactly the K-theory Euler classes. And then I have an extra factor that's there to annoy. And so now, well, these are K-theory generators, and it's possible to just play around with them and sort of see what you get from there. So that gets a very hands-on understanding of this equivalent K-theory of loops SU2. I think my time is up.